And this document by Baldwin sounds very contemporary if you read it now, because it remarks upon the strong connection between biological warfare, covert operations, and terrorism, and recommends that a special unit be set up to investigate this. And that became Special Operations, and for reasons that are obvious, the CIA took a great interest in this. And this unit began doing all manner of things sort of in that space of covert operations, terrorism, biological warfare, and this came to include a lot of things, including, you know, assassination, materials research, experiments over human populations, and drug and interrogation research using chemicals and other methods. And none of this was known in 1975. And obviously, once you know some of this, the scenario as it was portrayed then, well, this was just an Army scientist who was used as a guinea pig, and unfortunately he reacted badly, but we did our best to take care of him. But again, you know, God knows we tried our best, but when we weren't looking, he jumped out the window. That's essentially the story as it was told in 75. I call that the fairy tale. It sort of stands up a little bit if you know nothing about the context. Once you do know something about the context, I think of it as the emperor's new clothes. I mean, it's basically stripped naked, and there's sort of not much there to hold on to. In any case, the connections between what my father was doing at Dietrich and the kinds of things he was involved with on the one hand, and his death on the other, have become stronger and stronger over the years. And the culminating point for this, the point that we've reached now, came a year and a half ago or so, in May 2001, when in April an article, a very good article actually, had appeared in the New York Times magazine by Michael Ignatieff, whose name you will recognize. He's a Canadian.
We're very familiar with him.
Good, yes. Well, that article is available on the website, and I recommend you look at it, because the link to that article links you to the Times' own website, where they have put links to much of the other Times coverage from the 70s and beyond. In any case, after Michael's article appeared in the Times, I received a call from somebody who I hadn't heard from or of in basically 40 years. This was a guy who was probably my father's closest friend and a very close colleague with him in the laboratory during the Second World War. They had designed the protective clothing together for the invasion of Normandy should the troops have been met with biological or chemical agents. And this man, his name is Norman Knoyer, called me and said, "Eric, you know, I haven't really been following the story much over the years, but I read this article in the Times, and I have to tell you, you got everything right except one thing." And I said, "Really, what's that?" He said, "The historical context." I said, "Oh, that." He goes, "Yes, you have not understood the importance of Korea to this whole story, but I'm not going to tell you this on the phone." So I traveled to see him and spent 3 days with him, during which he told me a great many things. One of them was that in the late 40s, my father had actually changed the form of his employment. He had become a CIA officer. Now, this is something we had gotten wind of before, but we hadn't had it confirmed in quite so direct a form as this statement from my father's old colleague. It appears in the documents we got from Colby, though we thought at the time this must be a kind of a misspeech in some sense, and it also occurs in William Colby's own autobiography called Honorable Men that was published in 1979. In both of those, my father's referred to as either a CIA employee or in Colby's book as a CIA officer. But my father's colleague said this directly, that yes, he had begun working for the CIA in the late 40s, and he had begun work in something that was called at the time information retrieval, which sounds like some aspect of library science, but it was anything but that. It was extreme methods of interrogation, and at the time in the late 40s, early 50s, there was intense interest in interrogating a great many people about in various parts of the world about what was known and what was being done in the field of biological warfare, and they needed somebody with the content expertise that my father had in order to evaluate what was being done. And they also needed to bring to bear the kinds of chemical expertise that was being developed in this special operations lab for use in interrogations. And this was all called Project Artichoke. which preceded MKUltra. The name MKUltra is much more familiar, but two projects that preceded it, one called Blueberg and one called Artichoke, had their roots in World War II and were basically involved with methods of interrogation. And this later kind of expanded to include behavior and mind control, and that's when it got rechristened MKUltra. But my father's work in Artichoke took him to Germany a number of times, and according to my father's old colleague, this was where a sort of crisis of conscience began to really become intense for my father, because he was, you know, witnessing and in some sense participating in interrogations that were not infrequently terminal, meaning that the subject would die either, you know, as a result of the extreme methods that were applied to him or that he was put to death at the end. And these methods included a combination of drugs, electroshock, and torture. So this was very, very extreme stuff. And my father's colleague said that, you know, when my father came back from these trips, he was really horrified. And when he came back from the last one in the summer of 53, he was very, very distraught and said that he wanted to leave. The CIA had really had enough. Now, it was also from this work, or this work in combination with the work at Dietrich, that my father apparently learned that biological weapons were being used in Korea at this time. Now, this was something that fit with what my mother had always said, which was that during the early 50s, my father had been very concerned about whether this was occurring in Korea or not, and she didn't know whether he was in a position to have known and whether he did actually know, but she knew that this issue was very much upsetting to him. And as you know, this was an extremely controversial thing during the Korean War itself, because allegations had been made both by the Koreans, the Chinese, and also by these captured American pilots. And all of this was, you know, strenuously discredited by the Americans. There's an excellent book, again written by two Canadians, Stephen Endicott and Ned Hagerman at York University, which is a must-read in this connection. It's called The United States and Biological Warfare, Secrets from the Early Cold War in Korea. And I had read this book before meeting my father's colleague, but had not known exactly what to make of it. What Endicott and Hagerman say, and it'd be interesting to chat with them in this connection too, is that biological weapons were used in Korea by the United States, albeit on a kind of experimental basis. This was exactly what my father's colleague said as well, that the Americans felt they needed to test biological weapons under something like actual field conditions, and they took the opportunity of the Korean War to do it. And certainly they were up against the wall in Korea. I mean, that was a very scary, it was called a conflict at the time, but you know, a million Koreans died. It was actually a very intense war, as you know, and almost became a nuclear war. So it does seem as if biological weapons were used there, and this was not a top secret. This would have been a state secret. So if my father had been raising this issue in almost any context, alarm bells would have gone off everywhere.
Well, we've done actually a lot of work about Korea and about the Korean War, and I have met Professor Endicott.
Have you?
And yes, and I've invited him to be on the program, and he seems a bit hesitant for some reason to come on the show or talk about it on the radio.
Oh, really?
I don't know why. But the kinds of things that evidently were done, just for our audience's knowledge, release of feathers infected with anthrax.
Right.
Fleas and mosquitoes dosed with plague and yellow fever, and rodents infected with a variety of different diseases.
Right.
And so this is the kind of thing that the U.S. government was, I would say, pretty much undoubtedly doing at this time, and the evidence is mounting, not only from Professor Endicott and Hagerman's book, but also from the story of Frank R. Olson.
Yes. Well, one of the things that Stephen Endicott said to me was, he said that if my father's old colleague, Norman Conoyer, went on record, this would really make history, because no one in a position to know anything has ever said anything about this. And that's been one of the reasons why this has been an intensely vitriolic debate for literally half a century. And after I spent, you know, 3 days with this colleague, he became quite ill. The stress of telling me what he told me was almost did him in. And after I left, his wife called me and said that, you know, as soon as you left, Norman started vomiting. And I said, well, you know, sometimes I have that effect on people. And she said he was really sick for literally 6 months. But then, amazingly, he did grant an interview to this German crew that made the film Codename Artichoke that I referred to earlier. And he is interviewed there, and he does say these things on camera, which is, you know, it's something like a miracle that this happened. And because it's the first time that this door has been wedged open even a little bit by someone who was involved and who had, you know, had access to data about this.
Now that we know that your father had access to and knew of experiments, or that the U.S. government used weapons such as this in the Korean War and the various other programs they were involved with, it is your belief that the U.S. government murdered Frank R. Olson because of the information that he knew?
Yes, essentially. I think they were really backed into a corner. I think what happened was that during the summer of 53, when he came back from Germany and had seen these experiments and now knew about what had been happening in Korea and so on, he went through a kind of moral crisis. And apparently he went to see a psychiatrist with a security clearance in England and revealed to him the sort of moral crisis that he was in at the time. And this psychiatrist, his name is William Sargent, wrote one of the early books on brainwashing. And apparently my father, you know, made the mistake of trusting and confiding in him, but apparently Sargent then, you know, revealed that in their language of the day, you know, Frank Olson had gone soft. And it now seems like the experiment at Deep Creek Lake, in which my father was drugged, was designed to really test his loyalty and to find out exactly where he stood. The way I imagine this to have occurred is that once they drugged him, they kind of painted themselves into a corner, because they now had, to some extent, destabilized him, and they had certainly made him very angry. And he wanted to quit. I mean, he went into work on the Monday morning after this, you know, notorious Deep Creek Lake experiment, saying that he wanted to quit. That wasn't told in the stories that were circulated in 1975, but that's what happened. He went in and said he wanted to quit. He was then immediately taken off to New York on a Tuesday morning, and Friday night he was dead. And I think they felt they had basically no choice. He was having a kind of crisis. They couldn't discredit him. I mean, you have to really understand the tenor of the times. This was just 2 weeks after the papers to discredit Robert Oppenheimer had been drawn up. There was a tremendous paranoia about stopping or intervening in any sorts of weapons development. And my father had just an incredibly central strategic position in between the CIA and the bacteriological warfare establishment, and involved with all these kinds of programs of internal interrogation and knowledge about experiments and so on, and use of biological weapons. And I think what happened was they whisked him off to New York. They brought him, among other things, to see a magician, if you can believe it, this John Mulholland. There's a long article about Mulholland on the website as well. Mulholland was a magician with whom they consulted about a variety of things, including how to slip drugs into drinks, but also how to, you know, use the magician's art to create cover stories by distracting attention from the main event. In any case, they took him to see Mulholland, probably to create amnesia. This was one of the things that the Artichoke program was very interested in. Can you, you know, interrogate somebody and then create amnesia for the whole experience? But apparently this did not work. And the more techniques they tried to use to kind of neutralize the threat posed by my father, I think the worse their situation became. And in the end, I think they felt they had no choice but to do away with him and make it look like an accident. And one of the most dramatic things in this regard was that in 1997, I discovered the CIA's 1953 assassination manual, which describes how to create what they call a contrived accident in order to disguise a murder as a suicide or an accident. And the method that they say is the preferred one is to, quote, drop the subject from a high window or rooftop at least 75 feet onto a hard surface. So I think this is what happened. And one of the things the manual says, which is quite amazing when you know the Frank Olson story, it says if you do this effectively, the assassin/witness doesn't have to make a hasty retreat. He simply has to say that he didn't see anything. And this is exactly what Lashbrook said, or at least the conventional wisdom of what he said is that he didn't see anything. He did actually tell other versions of this in which he says he did see my father run across the room and plunge through the window. So they didn't have their stories entirely straight here. And that, again, is part of the suspicious aspect of this whole event. But in any case, the fit between what happened to my father and the assassination manual was so stunning that the New York District Attorney was looking into this, said it, you know, it was the assassination manual of the CIA read like a script for the murder, and the only question was which came first, the murder or the manual.
If I understand correctly, you believe that the murder was the end game of the government, or do you believe that the U.S. drugged Frank Olson with the intent to kill him?
You know, it's hard to know that. I mean, first of all, I think there was more than one drugging. If you're talking about the drugging that occurred, what, 8 days earlier,
right?
I doubt that that early drugging was with the intent to kill him. I mean, one can't know this entirely, but that seems rather far-fetched. But there were other drugs given while he was in New York, and what the purpose of that was is anyone's guess. I think there probably was an intent to use drugs in order to either create the probability of suicide or to aid and abet the plans to drop him out the window. So yes, drugs played a role in this.
Well, that brings us to the present day and the war on terror and the things that you view as now through special eyes, I guess, because of your experience and your family's experience.
Brings us up to the moment, but also in a very, you know, incredible way, it brings us full circle, not only to the return of anthrax and other things, but also to the return of the very characters who were involved in the cover-up in 75, which is quite dizzying. Again, about a year ago, we discovered documents from the Gerald Ford White House in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which show that the reason we were invited to meet the president so quickly in 1975 was because there was concern that we might go to court. If we went to court, we would have a right to know what my father was doing, and the government under no conditions would reveal what my father was doing. Therefore, they would have no defense whatsoever to a court suit. This is what they were telling to each other, meanwhile they're telling us we shouldn't go to court because we'd probably lose. The senior staff guys for Gerald Ford at that time were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, which is quite staggering given the positions they now hold.
So they held very high position then. They hold even higher position now. They obviously know an awful lot about the U.S. government's use of germ warfare itself. They're seeing the same, if indeed this Al-Qaeda network and others are posing a threat to the United States or other countries through germ warfare, it's certainly no different than what threat the United States government posed or still poses to other countries like North Korea and China and others we probably will never know about.
Well, exactly. And one of the reasons why the United States, you know, was able to use and wanted to use biological weapons in 52 and 53 in Korea was because they were deniable for the same reasons that terrorists want to use them now, which is you can simply say, we didn't do it, the evidence has been planted, blah, blah, blah. And that's why it became such a debate that had no end. So a lot of this stuff has this incredibly contemporary feel to it.
What do you think of this scientist who's now being probed, his apartment searched, and he's being put under the 500 megawatt lamp?
Yeah. Well, I have no special insight into that investigation, and I really shouldn't pretend to have any. I think it does seem to be moving very, very slowly, and one has to wonder, as Christoph, this columnist in the Times, has been saying, one has to wonder if there's a reason why they don't really want to come to a conclusion. Does this guy know stuff that would come out if he were indicted or whatever? I mean, I don't know, but it certainly seems a little bit bogus. There's something, you know, worrisome about the way the investigation is being handled.
And
but beyond that, I really can't comment.
And this is happening in the town that you live in right now, isn't
right,
it?
Right. Yeah. It's very strange, because I came back here 8 years ago or so, basically to look into what happened in 1953, and you know, now all of that is sort of coming back and hitting me from the other side. So it's been a very strange period of time. And following this Frank Olson case lands you, you know, not back in 53, but with what's happening at the moment.
So we can safely say that the United States government did immense research into germ warfare, and that probably a lot of that immense research we're seeing today as supposedly the threat.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that I would say here is that, you know, that's striking from the story of my father and our long attempts to figure out what happened is just the amazing feat of disinformation that has been mounted around this story. I mean, this story was presented in 1975 as a mind control story, as a drug experiment going awry. There was no hint of any connection to biological warfare whatsoever. I mean, nobody even stopped to realize that my father was a bacteriological warfare scientist of the most senior status and working in the most secret biological warfare laboratory in the country. That whole aspect was kept out of things. And that's what I've been trying to do now is re-spin the story. It was spun so hard that it has a kind of tendency to revert back to being a drug suicide story. But that's not what it was. And that's been my effort to kind of make it clear that this involves bacteriological weapons, biological warfare.
And I think what audiences today may not understand is what a big profile this story about this jump from the window had, the supposed jump from the window had back in 1975. It was a huge story.
It was a huge story, really. And that was, yeah, because it played into all the cultural, you know, preoccupations of the time, the whole counterculture, and the, you know, much was made of the irony that the CIA, by being an early pioneer in LSD and drug research, had laid the, you know, foundation for the, ironically, for the, you know, blossoming of the counterculture and drugs and so on. And this just became an immensely fascinating story, but made it all the more difficult to penetrate for me what it was really about. I mean, it's taken another 25 years, another quarter of a century, to get to the heart of this matter.
Well, it's a fascinating story.
Final question.
Yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
Question. My final question is: have you or any of your family met Lashbrook?
Yes, we did. We in 1984 we. You know, we made various periodic runs at this story to try to get deeper, and one of the most intense periods in this regard was in 1984 when we went to see Sidney Gottlieb, had several long sessions with him, and then went to the West Coast to meet Robert Lashbrook.
What was that like?
Well, it was incredibly unsatisfying. I mean, Lashbrook was a nervous wreck, he was... He was jumping up and down in the chair and kind of blurting out things, some of which, you know, seemed completely ridiculous. And then, you know, in the midst of trying to cling to the old cover story, he would then blurt out something that was completely unknown to us that kind of pointed in another direction. One of the things I realized about a story like this is that, you know, people say when a story is so old, you can't, it's very difficult to make progress. But the opposite is also true to some extent, which is once the story is very old, people forget what their cover story was. Yes, in 1984, we did travel to the West Coast to see Lashbrook. This was after we had met with Sidney Gottlieb at his home in Virginia. And the meeting with Lashbrook was very, very unsatisfying. He was essentially a nervous wreck during the whole meeting, jumping nervously up and down in his chair and blurting out things and claiming to forget things and so on. But it was also intermittently very illuminating because he would at times forget what the cover story was supposed to be and, you know, inadvertently reveal things that were actually very, very highly classified. One example there is that he emphasized that during the short week that my father was in New York from a Tuesday till Friday when he died, Sidney Gottlieb had actually been with the group the whole time, which is something I had imagined, that Gottlieb, this was such a crisis that Gottlieb would be trying to shepherd things from a near position. But the conventional story was that Gottlieb had been minding the store back in Virginia and Washington and was nowhere to be seen in New York. That's what he had told us, and that's what the Colby documents emphasized. But Lashbrook said that Gottlieb had been there the whole time. And this, of course, you know, fit with what, you know, we would have expected to have been the case.
Do you strongly believe that Lashbrook was involved with the murder of your father?
Well, it depends on what you mean by involved. I don't think he's the one who physically did it. I think, first of all, he's a rather frail guy, and, you know, physically, I think would not have been able to manage it. Second of all, from a kind of need-to-know compartmentalization strategy, they wouldn't have wanted him to have done it or to even see it, which I think has been one of the reasons why he can't get the story straight. I think he was told to wait in the toilet. Which is where he was found when they entered the room, when the police and the night manager entered the room. I think it was the wet work, as it's called, was done by thugs and not by Lashbrook himself.
Okay.
We have some indication of that from various investigators who have looked into this, and that, you know, this may become better known later on. At the moment, I can't really say more about this, and the details of this have not really been made public, but it appears that Lashbrook wasn't the guy who physically did it.
Any other parting words that you and your brother Nils would like to say to our audience?
Maybe Nils has something. Is there anything you'd like to say, Nils?
I would just say that this has been a decades-long struggle to find out what the truth really was. Some people have characterized this as being an effort on the part of, particularly on the part of my brother, for Eric to simply prove that our father was murdered. And I would just say that I absolutely believe that this has been a family struggle to establish the truth, no matter what that truth might be. And in every instance, we have found very clearly that evidence continually points in the direction of murder, and in no instance has it pointed away from that. So it has been a very difficult struggle for our family to simply arrive at what the truth was as to what the actual nature of our father's death was.
One of the motivations that kept me going during this time was that I kept realizing that whatever was going to emerge about my father and how he actually died, the search had a kind of, you know, what you'd call in philosophy, heuristic value, because it was constantly turning up things. It was as if, you know, you couldn't resolve the death of Frank Olson one way or the other without, you know, plowing a very wide field, and in that field you were going to discover, you know, an amazing array of things that were going to be of interest to, you know, a lot of people for a lot of other reasons. You know, maybe as a concluding thing here, one of the things that strikes me is that given the kinds of activities that the United States was engaged in during the Cold War, and particularly, you know, some of the things my father's group was engaged in, which they were learning both from the Japanese and their horrendous bacteriological experiments in Manchuria, and from the Nazis in terms of their interrogation experiments and their bacteriological warfare things. And at the same time, you know, in the post-Nuremberg period, when the United States was trying to take the high ground on all questions involving these sorts of issues, you get into a position where how are you going to avoid, you know, what you might call national security homicide? How are you going to avoid that if you're doing all these things, and if along the way somebody, if not going to become a, you know, explicit whistleblower, is at least going to start raising extremely awkward questions? So far from being some kind of conspiratorial vendetta here, it seems to me the logic points to the plausibility of this if you simply know the historical context.
And the people that you were, in a sense, battling with are right there up in the major leagues of government today. So,
right.
Well, I think you've done a great service to your family, and I think you've done a great service to humanity by looking into this.
Well, thank you. And again, if anyone would like to receive the family statement, which lays this out in a fairly deliberate and careful way, you can send me an email to collage@fred.net, and I'll send you one. Thank you.
And it's www.frankolsonproject.org, and that is Olson spelled Olson. And today we've had on the line with us Eric Olson and Nils Olson, the sons of Frank R. Olson. So thank you very much, and very pleased to have had you on the air today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks very much.